The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, if we were watching a game, we were just talking about this, and let's say it's football, okay, and the NFL commissioner was there, and he started changing the rules as the game was going on, of course, to keep people entertained, you know, because runaway games, a lot of times those aren't entertaining.
You don't want big winners, and you certainly don't want big losers.
So what does that do for the game, though, if you start changing the rules in the middle of the game?
Well, it definitely changes how people bet on the game, and to the degree that you can judge what the NFL commissioner is going to change next, you will either win or lose in Vegas. But as far as the consumer is concerned, the viewer of this great drama, yes, it's designed to be entertaining, but that's the key word, design. There's nothing really natural here.
Right, and so you don't really know what decision to make next. If you're a coach and you don't know whether the end zone is the touchdown or whether we've decided to start kicking field goals for more points.
The point for us is that when you look at monetary policy today, it's really not that much different than the NFL commissioner, quote-unquote, making it up as he goes along, because it's the difference between discretionary policy measures and rules-based management of the monetary system. And what we have today in the form of Ben Bernanke, and certainly in the latter years of our esteemed former chairman, Mr. Greenspan, you had more discretion given to the process instead of rules that they were following. That for years, we saw the ECB do the exact opposite, where everything was rules-based. And actually, by almost German hard-edge calculus, you're not meeting the rules, you're out. And everyone needs to be a winner in our economy. Everyone needs to be a winner because really that's what our education system is geared us towards. Everyone is a winner, Kevin. Everyone.
Well, and David, where you're going is we have a debt-based consumer society that's been taught to just consume, borrow, consume, borrow, consume. The problem is that doesn't have sustainability. And, you know, back in the old days, let's go back to the gold standard. That was a true rule. I mean, if you didn't have the gold, you couldn't go spend the money. Now, you could still borrow, but you had to pay back in gold. Everything balanced out in the end.
Well, and frankly, wealth was not based on how much credit you had access to. Wealth was according to what you had saved and foregone in terms of present pleasure for future investment. You saw wealth grow over time, the classic way, via compounding. Now, in fact, we have an entire society that is compounding, negatively working against them, because it's not assets that are growing exponentially, it's debt on their balance sheet, which is growing exponentially, which really mirrors what we do at the federal level, too.
Well, speaking of the federal, okay, now these guys aren't truly federal, but they gave themselves the name of it. The Federal Reserve Act probably is where that discretion started. I mean, that was the seed. We may not have felt it completely until now, but the seed was back in 1913.
Well, and it really was the argument that men in the intellectual elite can and should determine the market, that the market itself was not smart enough, there was not enough actual attention being paid. And so what we've seen over the last 100 years, and by the way, next year is the 100-year anniversary of the U.S. Fed. The U.S. Fed and more recently the European Central Bank epitomized that move towards discretionary measures. And that's in stark contrast to the gold standard, which was a rules-oriented system. The Federal Reserve Act moved our monetary policies in the direction of being discretionary policies instead of operating automatic basis. Those policies being less discretionary, dependent on Fed leadership, current leadership, and of course, that's what we know today, entirely discretionary.
Okay, David, that brings up a great point, though. If we say it's unsustainable to continue to just borrow and spend, we're reaching that point where they're trying to make it look normal, but everybody knows there is a catastrophe about to occur. Give me some coming attractions. I mean, what are some of the possibilities as we go forward?
Well, Kevin, I think it would appear that there is a little window opening, and it could be in the next 2 to 3 to 4 years where there is an openness collectively to a new solution. That new solution will be much better or much worse than what we currently have, Kevin. And
right.
I think that this is where the discussion of the gold standard needs to be front and center. If there is a preview of coming attractions, I think we need to consider how we might reasonably return to the gold standard. Is there enough in terms of a collective group of people who care enough to create a well-grounded political and economic system for their children, for their grandchildren to inherit. Because it really is this. When you look at sound money is what leads to sound politics. Sound money is what leads to a sound fiscal state of affairs.
Right.
This is one of the things that we discussed nearly 2 years ago with Giulio Garrotti, the idea that in the post-World War II era, with democracy has come the politicization of the U.S. budget. Everybody has a stake in what government is spending, and this is really the problem. They can ask for it, and the Fed will print it. Government will deliver on these fiat promises because they have access to an infinite amount of fiat capital.
Well, and there's no pain in that right now, David, and that's one of the reasons why Americans aren't feeling the pain. In fact, that's one of the reasons we talked about last week why American buying is only about 2.5 times Vietnam for gold purchases. But so the Americans aren't feeling the pain yet, but here's my question. Can we keep our greatness as a nation, or are we all just getting tired enough to go for the security, to just have them continue to print money? Because there will be pain involved in rules.
Well, I think we need to throw down the challenge because, Kevin, as we talk to folks every day, there is a sense of tiredness. Like, they've done enough, and they assume that it's someone else's turn to take a hand at the till. And to be quite honest, this is when we need to press in and double down in terms of our commitment to this country of ours. This is a wonderful experiment, 200 years plus, and it is foundering not because of bad political ideas, but because we handed the responsibility of money printing to a private organization circa 1913. That is the problem, Kevin. And I say it's largely the problem because politics as we know it, as grand as it is, economics as we know it, as out of balance as it is, both are driven by one thing, access to unlimited money. That unlimited money is not on the basis of our wealth as a nation, but on the basis of a printing press. And that, unfortunately, has a moral component which we find repugnant.
Well, and you know, I hate to say this, but probably the innovation that has occurred in our lifetimes is the innovation of just being able to come up with this free money, this credit money. But actually, if you look at a period of time, I look at my library, David, and there's a period of time of American literature that I seem to have more of than any other. And it has to do with a period of time between 100 and 130 years ago. There was something about America, and actually even Europe at the time, we call it the Industrial Revolution, but people were producing things. But there was also something that was going on at that same time. Everyone was on a relatively equal footing because we had a worldwide currency system based on rules called the gold standard.
We like the success story of the gold standard. That era, at least for the United States, was sort of 1879 to 1914.
Right.
And there was a reflexive nature to that program. It was not driven by the sort of too clever for their own good academics. I want to give credit where credit is due. We are talking about very bright individuals, smart in their own right, just lacking some basic things like humility and really a penetrating sense of the real world. These academics that run the Fed and the us really run the world from behind the scenes.
So, David, when you're talking about too clever for their own good academics, now I can think of one guy from Princeton who's a too clever kind of guy who actually is at the helm right now using quite a bit of discretion.
CNBC interviewed him back in 2005, Ben Bernanke, and he was asked about the housing bubble, and he responded, well, I guess I don't buy your premise. It's a pretty unlikely possibility. We've never had a decline in housing prices on a nationwide basis. So what I think, what is more likely is that house prices will slow, maybe stabilize, might slow consumption spending a bit. I don't think it's going to drive the economy too far from its full employment path, though. That was his quote in 2005 when asked about derivatives and sort of the threat that they had. And of course, Warren Buffett talking about them in terms of being weapons of mass destruction. He said, I'm more sanguine about derivatives than the position you've just suggested. I think, generally speaking, they're very valuable. They provide methods by which risk can be shared, sliced and diced, and given to those most willing to bear them. They add, I believe, to the flexibility of the financial system in many different ways. With respect to their safety, derivatives, for the most part, are traded among very sophisticated financial institutions and individuals who have considerable incentive to understand them and use them properly. The Federal Reserve's responsibility is to make sure that the institutions it regulates have good systems and good procedures for ensuring that their derivative portfolios are well managed and not create excessive risk in the institutions. And then just the last quote by our resident genius at the Fed, Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago meeting in 2007, the statement, we do not expect significant spillovers from the subprime market to the rest of the economy or to the financial system, end quote.
Well, David, if this were the Gong Show, the gong would have gone off all three times. Every one of those quotes was wrong. And, you know, if you remember on the Gong Show, once they were gonged, they were off the show. Now, I'm not quite sure why we're still listening to these guys and watching on financial TV, waiting with bated breath for their every next statement when they've been completely off on all of those other things.
Kevin, I think this is the fascinating thing. The difference between a successful investor today and a non-successful investor will be the person's ability to tune out all of the white noise which is put on by both the academics and our current media. Because honestly, there are so many things that are supposed to be so very important that catch our attention, that are supposed to be motivating factors for us to take, quote unquote, just the right action. And the reality, Kevin, the reality is actually quite different. If you simply ignored it all, if you sat back and took long walks on a Sunday afternoon, if you never read the newspaper, do you know that you would be much better prepared to make intelligent decisions as an investor?
Well, let me bring up a good point then, okay? I had a client ask me the other day, you know, on the concept of deflation, because these guys are the same guys who tell us to fear deflation. Oh, no, there might be a turndown in prices. Things might fall in price. And my client just said, you know, Kevin, thinking about this, why would it be a problem if my money bought more goods instead of less every year?
And that's what's interesting. We have been taught to fear deflation with sort of the specter of the 1930s drug out and put on show as if to say, you see, this is what you get with deflation.
Oh, the pain, the suffering.
It's cruel. The markets are determining prices. This is dangerous. Monetary barbarism. Don't you think we need a better, a cleaner, a more polished approach to the markets?
We can keep this from ever happening again. In fact, that's a Bernanke statement.
And Kevin, this is the response. This is what we see today. Genius applied to the markets. Genius applied to our monetary policies. There's a book written several years ago, Kevin, and I think we might have a reprint coming out soon, but with a different cast of characters.
Are you thinking of When Genius Failed? Now, that was talking about a corporation failing. Are we talking now about a larger system failing?
Yes, and I think this is the reality. The reality of the gold standard period was that money bought more over time, not less.
Right.
Real goods and services cost less over time instead of more.
Well, and that's a natural balancing, Dave. When things slow down, things should cost less.
It's impossible for us to even imagine that set of circumstances because it's outside of our understanding. 1913 forward, it really got ramped up 1930s and 40s, really got ramped up even more in the 60s and 70s and 80s. But this idea that central banks intervene, central banks smooth out the business cycle and keep there from being corrections, but only a pro-cyclical, growth-oriented direction for the economy. Kevin, this is where we have primary struggles because actually we are seeing genius fail, though no one's acknowledging it as of yet.
Well, and I think we need to point out, too, there's a misunderstanding that this is free market dynamic that is causing inflation, but it's really not. The socialist academics right now, I mean, that which you learn in school, in fact, I've got to tell you, we live in a college town, and I was in the college parking lot today, and I saw bumper sticker after bumper sticker after bumper sticker. Now, I didn't have to predict what they all said, but you can probably fill in the gaps. It's usually the socialist way of thinking that says, oh, no, you don't want deflation. You definitely don't want a readjustment in price.
When ironically, it's the only objections to this sort of purchasing power advantage back in the day when we had the gold standard. And as we were leaving, we left the gold standard in 1914. The Federal Reserve was created in 1913 for different reasons, for very different reasons. There is a simply coincidence there in terms of when we left the gold standard. But it was the young socialist academics and labor organizers there in the 1880s, 90s, and at the turn of the century who were upsetting the American order on the basis of the influence of Marx and Engels. They did not like the capitalist system. They did not like the idea of the Industrial Revolution. They did not like the idea of a working class and a non-working class, the bourgeois and the proletariat. They were arguing that wages were depressed via the gold standard.
Sure, it was the gold's fault.
And they wanted something different for the working class. They wanted more inflation.
Well, and David, we got to see a model of that. I mean, that's like the logic of Haberstein in the 1920s in Germany. You just print more and more money.
Exactly. We just need a little bit more quantity of money, and all will be made right. And everyone will be, at least from the standpoint of those young socialist academics and labor organizers, all would be more equal if there was more money to go around.
Well, and for them, they may have really wanted to see more equality and think that, you know, earnestly feel like that equality would occur. But it rings true with Orwellian types of logic where all animals are created equal. Some are a little more equal than others.
Well, and it's interesting because it was silver during that period of time, 1880s, 1890s and whatnot, that was the inflationist's friend.
That was almost like printed money back then.
Well, it was, because relative to gold, there was a heck of a lot more of it.
Right. David, I think you need to elaborate on this a little bit more. Take us back 100-plus years when we had both metals. We had gold and we had silver as our monetary unit. But silver was favored by those who needed inflation, you know, those who produced crops, you know, people maybe who were in debt.
I certainly don't want to cast a bad light on someone who is inclined towards social justice and inclined towards looking for fairness and of opportunity and equal opportunity. These are issues that in a very fair and open discussion will emerge. My concern is really that we think of any system, if it embeds an inflationary component into it, it becomes subject to political manipulation. Money becomes a means of entrenching politicians, as in the current system of corrupt politicians maintaining their positions of power via the redistribution of tax dollars, number one, and number two, the extra capital required to meet those political obligations, complements of none other than the Fed and the Treasury, this sort of enmeshed relationship that exists between them. So we can't meet all the needs. We can't promise pie-in-the-sky programs. We can't give the sun, moon, and stars to our constituency groups if we have a sound money policy. In other words, you're limited in what you can promise, knowing that there's limitations on what you can actually deliver, and we would be much more inclined, in terms of the body politic, to not make outrageous claims about where we're going to spend money that we don't have if, in fact, we lived within our means as a country.
Well, and David, just an aside, I mean, we really like silver as an investment now because we're on a fiat currency system. Silver as money alongside of gold had problems coming because, well, look at Spain. Okay, the Spanish crown, when there was a massive infusion of silver into the market, you all of a sudden had this inflationary and political pressure to move things over to silver.
Yeah, and actually you did see something of an inflationary trend with the California gold rush,
right,
when they found gold, but it was so infinitesimally small it didn't matter. And you had the same with the Klondike run and the major rush in Alaska. What we saw affect the Spanish crown was a massive devaluation. They were on a silver standard. It was akin to hyperinflation, and ironically it was through tangibles, and it was as the mines of Central and South America flooded the money supply, destroyed the economy, and eventually the crown along with it.
Well, isn't inflation sort of deceptive? Because at first you think it's your friend, especially if your wages are going up quicker than maybe other things. But actually, inflation is no one's friend in the long run.
In interim periods, the wealthy have assets which appreciate with inflation. And as you mentioned, the poor, under certain circumstances, have access to more money. But there is a circumstance that we know as stagflation, which doesn't help anyone.
Mm-hmm.
If wages are not rising, the Jennings Bryans fans of the world, the Bernanke fans of the world, they're not being quote-unquote taken care of.
Well, David, we've talked about this financial repression before, and what you have right now is you have prices. Everyone's wondering why they're running out of month just a little earlier with what they're paying, and it's because inflation has been in the system for a long, long time, and we really haven't experienced a true slowdown until about 2008. And even in 2008, we didn't really experience a true slowdown, but it's catching up, and we're starting to talk to people, and they're like, you know what? It's crazy, but I'm running out of money.
You know what? One of the very important things here is this. What we experience with snaps of inflation can be temporary and painful, but we've now had elevated levels of inflation. Of course, it's been disguised through use of the CPI, and now they're talking about using a chained versus non-chained number, which would give them the flexibility of calling current CPI an overstated number, if you can believe that.
Mm.
But, Kevin, what we have today is a saturation throughout the economy. If you look at balance sheets across the country, really income statements for corporations, you have a saturation which has occurred. Any additional inflation from here is of a terminal nature. It's not an inflation shock, sort of a one-off deal which we can adjust to.
Right.
We've been coping our best to adjust to the inflation which has already occurred and been obscured by government.
Well, and David, you've brought out in the past that, you know, we in America may be able to experience inflation for quite a bit longer than the person who can only afford two or three bowls of rice a day. Inflation for them can actually put them out of eating.
It seems to me that we're at a critical point in history. And this is sort of a conclusion that I think we need to come to grips with as individuals. We either begin to direct our national destiny or assume that within the next 10 years, we have an absolute political and social free-for-all. Mm-hmm. And I would strongly urge anyone considering relocation outside of the United States to reconsider. If you're identifying problems that need to be and actually won't likely be solved, you are the exact type of person needed to stand in the political and economic gap and invest all you are, all that you are as an individual, all the capital that that brings to the table, as well as perhaps all that you have to this great country of ours. Sound money equals sound economics. Sound money equals sound and bridled politics. There is no party solution. This is not Democrats. This is not Republicans. There is, however, a solution which all parties must be governed by, and that is sound money.
Well, and David, you have talked about this in the past, about it is important to have maybe assets overseas, some of your assets, so that you still have a war chest and you can perform here in the United States for what you need to do. But as far as leaving, you know, one of the guys I was talking to, he said, okay, so you go to Ecuador, so you go to all these different countries. You know, you're still one bullet away from a banana republic.
Well, Kevin, switching gears to Europe, because we mentioned Spain, the Spanish crown, and the devaluation of silver.
What a surprise, Spain. Didn't we talk about Spain after Greece and before Italy and before Ireland? Isn't there a sequence of events here that everyone's acting surprised about?
Right, and now they're in a double-dip recession.
Yeah, okay.
The real challenge here is that you have inflation, which is on the rise. You also have unemployment, which is on the rise. One in four people is unemployed. Hmm. Now, if you're looking at youth unemployment, it's one out of two. So 50% unemployed in terms of youth unemployment. This is against Spain.
Right.
But across the general public, the general populace, it's now one in four. 24.4%, nearly 25% of the nation is unemployed.
Hmm.
Tell me that's not the seedbed for revolution. Tell me that's not the seedbed for revolution. We discussed this maybe 18 months ago, where just as a thought experiment, you have someone introduce a new novel idea into the political conversation, which is, we don't work for the Germans, we don't work for anyone in Europe, because frankly, we're Spanish before we're European.
We're starting to see this in France as well, David. I mean, at this point, we're starting to see socialism return to France. That in itself is going to change the whole dynamic of the Eurozone.
Well, you're right, and we should talk about France in a minute, but you've got the UK last week. You've got Spain, which announced over the weekend. No real surprises there.
Right.
The list is growing. UK, Spain, Greece, Italy, Portugal, Ireland, Belgium, Denmark, Holland, the Czech Republic, Slovenia, all of these countries are now back in recession.
So it's more than just the acronym that works so well, PIGS. This is a whole... There's a lot of countries here.
All of them. Well, debt in the Eurozone right now is behaving almost like a pigeon, if you will. It wants to return to its roost. And this is what's interesting, because with the introduction of the Eurozone, there was a lot of cross-border purchases where the rage was, again, at the outset of the Euro project, to buy the debt of your neighboring country.
Mm.
Now there's not so much of an appetite, and new purchasers are not the banks across the national border lines, but are limited to really the domestic commercial banks and the domestic central banks. Our challenge here is this: as we look back at history and we look forward, in our experience, the sponge, if you will, is more quickly saturated if you're dealing with a local market funding the debt markets alone.
Once again, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. Okay, so David, this sounds to me like it's inflationary ultimately, because these countries, once you saturate, you have to either print money or come up with some other solution. They can't tax it. We know that.
Yeah, so hang in there, because that's how we would actually connect the dots. When you're dealing with a funding crisis, when you're dealing with an inability to roll over debt, or you're, right now at least, dealing with a limited audience of people who are interested in your debt, ultimately, you saturate that sponge. There, you run out of people who will continue to buy your debt. When that occurs, then something critical happens. You have to decide what debts you're intending to pay, or if you're intending to pay all of them, what resources you're going to use to make payment on that debt. You can increase taxes, of course, but the less contentious way is to try to subtly throttle the circumstance and increase inflation. Print money to pay off those debts as time goes on. So really what we see in Europe right now, as we speak, we're anticipating a future tense terminal problem for many of the Euro countries. Real dire inflations can only begin in earnest when the debt markets have been fully throttled to exhaustion and there are no more savings savings to employ towards paying real-time expenditures.
Okay, now, David, I'm going to take you back over to the French question, because France, there's nothing unusual about France moving towards socialism. Now, what makes it unusual this time is there is a Franco-German coordination that is occurring right now that we call the Eurozone, okay? These other countries, the PIGS and all the other, you know, acronyms, they are less important than this union between Germany and France. And, of course, under Sarkozy, you know, you had Merkel and Sarkozy.
Merkozy. Yeah. A very cozy relationship between Merkel and her French counterpart.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you then, you've got an awful lot of people right now who are analyzing this European situation and saying this new person who's likely to be elected is going to be changing that dynamic. Now, how critical is that to the whole European project?
Of particular note to us is the fact that Monsieur Francois Hollande has never held a job outside of government. You know the statement, when you're 25 and you're a socialist, it's legitimate because everyone knows that you have a heart. But by the time you're 35, if you're still a socialist, everyone knows that you don't have a brain.
That sounds like Winston
Churchill. He was 26
yeah.
in 1979 when he joined the Socialist Party. It's now 2012.
He never matures.
He never matured. We know that he doesn't have a brain.
Okay, but David, the question is this a death knell for the Eurozone? I mean, when you've got a socialist there and then trying to work with the German side, which is a rules-oriented basis, what's going to happen there?
It appears that there are more spending programs in the works where fairness, justice, and equality become the hallmarks. And it's difficult to say that there's anything wrong with fairness or justice or equality. But what we know from the French, honestly, is that how you define your terms is absolutely critical because, again, and again, this may just be from an American perspective. This may not be the death knell for the Eurozone. But from a decidedly American perspective, we interpreted liberty, equality, and fraternity a bit differently as well. So I'd like to see what he means by fairness, justice, and equality. And if it doesn't include a massive dose of government spending, I would be shocked and amazed. For us, frankly, to the period of Mitterrand, and perhaps that period where the franc was under attack because it was the means by which you were going to carry out every social program. You could overpromise and actually deliver as long as you were willing to compromise the quality of your currency.
Well, and liberty, equality, and fraternity here in America used to mean individual rights and responsibilities. It's that second part that a lot of people like to forget these days. They like their rights, but they don't like the responsibility that comes with it. David, in America, liberty, equality, and fraternity used to mean individual rights, and individual responsibilities. So looking at the French situation, I think there's probably, we just need to stay tuned because there's probably going to be some sort of compromise between the socialism and then, of course, the rules of the German austerity.
Well, and it was Mitterrand who got to come in and criticize the European monetary system, the EMS system that Giscard was involved in up to that point. And you basically had a strong currency position, not unlike what you have with the euro and these strict rules that have to be applied. Mitterrand came in and said, this is frankly balderdash. We have the ability to become a great nation. Again, we will do this. We have people who have needs and we're not meeting them. And again, social programs galore, government spending galore, and it was at the expense of the French franc. Mm-hmm. It feels a little bit like a return to that with Francois Hollande.
So 1982 again.
Exactly. Do we have another 1982 in the offing for the French people? Someone's going to be very happy because there's going to be more teachers, there's going to be more government programs, there's going to be more government employees. The question is, who will pay those bills?
Well, you don't have to, Dave. We now live in the day and age of inflation, and the European Central Bank's looking more and more like the Federal Reserve.
It is, as you pointed out a few minutes ago, Kevin, the old conflict between priorities of one country against priorities of another. This is the basic conflict that you still have within the Euroland, because you deal with national politics, you deal with national interests, and yet we're all supposed to be thinking with a collective mind, and it's not working.
Well, and David, you brought up discretionary policy measures right from the get-go when we first started talking. There is a difference between using your discretion, changing the rules all the time, and actually having to play by a set series of rules. Now, I'm going to bring us back home, okay, because Egan Jones is a rating agency that's not paid by the guys that they're rating, okay? So they're independent. This is another word that we talked about. And so they have a responsibility to report, not what they're paid to report, like some of the other rating agencies.
All of the other rating agencies.
Okay, all of the other rating agencies. But these guys are the go-to guys if you want an independent report, a good audit. Now, what's happening with Egan Jones right now since they came out with some bad news?
Well, the bad news, interestingly, was that the U.S. needs to be downgraded, that we are not the best bet We're not the same vet that we thought we were as AAA status.
You're talking about treasuries.
Yes. And so there's some compromise taking place on the U.S. balance sheet. They're willing to say that we have an issue here and we need to pay attention to it. Now, wouldn't you know, within 10 days of talking about negative issues relating to U.S. debt, the SEC is like,
We need to investigate you.
And lo and behold, Egan Jones is being investigated by the SEC.
So this is almost like the NFL commissioner coming in and saying, wait a second, yeah, I understood that you ran the ball all the way down the field inbounds, but guess what? We're going to move the inbounds just a couple of yards and now investigate you.
Again, there's a couple of things that you have to know. One, as you mentioned, they're the only rating agency in the market with independent relationships. They're not being paid by the people who they're grading, so to say. Those are called bought ratings, if you will. I mean, if you want a AAA, you basically belly up to the bar. And this is what was done. This is what, in our view, is unconscionable. If you go back to the 2005, 6, and 7 period, the asset-backed securities market, the mortgage-backed securities market, if you needed AA or AAA, and guess what? That's how the shadow banking system grew exponentially, because as long as it was AA or AAA, you had to have, as a financial institution, very little capital set aside against it. You could leverage your portfolio, leverage your balance sheet considerably as long as it was AA or AAA. Now, who provided the AA or AAA? You fill in the blank. Every rating agency except Egan Jones. In fact, Egan Jones was out there saying in the 2007-2008 period, folks, we've got a problem with mortgage-backed securities. Folks, we've got a major issue with the quality of the paper you're talking about. We will have to disagree. This is not AA or AAA. I don't think A even fits in the equation. Now, in retrospect, they're looked at as heroes for their work with mortgage-backed securities and in the asset-backed securities market. I think they'll be exonerated, but the reality is they are challenging the Leviathan at its most vulnerable point.
Well,
this,
and
is,
David,
this is the other critical point.
Okay, but David, I will tell you, in a day and age where managing perception of the people is more important than the rules, okay, just like managing the perception of this ballgame we were talking about as an analogy, when you're managing perception and you're the little kid who comes out and says the king has no clothes on, that can be very, very dangerous.
Right. So if I wore the Machiavellian hat of no particular congressperson, actually any of our congresspeople today, I might say to myself, we're running out of money. Between you, me, and the fence post, we're running out of money, and now, frankly, we're playing for time.
Right.
What can we do to extend the time we have in order to address the fiscal disaster, which is either immediately ahead of us, or if we're successful, perhaps we can push it into the future? Well, it's only a problem if people recognize it's a problem.
Right.
Now, this raises the issue, is anyone creating problems for us in this regard? In other words, is someone saying that we have a problem? Because if they're saying we have a problem, then we actually do have a problem to address. We can't afford the general public to be concerned about things that they should be trusting us to address and take care of. You see, Kevin, our education system for 30 to 40 years, if not longer, has taught us to trust authority. If you have a PhD behind your name, if you have any number of letters behind your name, that is the great social legitimizer. Your opinion is worth more with letters behind your name. It doesn't even matter if you understand what those letters mean. If I have six letters behind my name and you have never seen them before, you put more confidence in my opinions than otherwise. And you could prove this statistically, but this is what is being challenged. The professional political elite have a lot at stake, and this is what they're having to conclude.
Well,
again, putting that Machiavellian hat on.
David, they're managing a potential catastrophe. Now, let's face it. When you're talking about coming out and saying, we're out of money, we're playing for time, what you're talking about is actually addressing reality. Now, we just passed the 100th anniversary of the Titanic sinking. And if you study what occurred during that little over two-hour period, it was so hard for people to get their heads around the fact that they were sinking. Now, the guy who actually designed the ship is the guy who said, you know what, this thing's going to sink. Okay, the five compartments have been torn open, and it's flooding over the bulkheads. So he knew, but not everybody knew. There were a lot of people who refused to get in the lifeboats because it was more comfortable on deck. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago. Now, if we do have a catastrophe that is coming, I mean, when you've got too much debt and it can't be paid and your monetary system is completely based on consumption, that sounds to me like a potential catastrophe. So are there solutions that keep that from occurring?
Well, and that's, I think, what Congress and government is seeking right now. What needs to be done with or to those people who would reveal, again, for the sake of the country, quote-unquote, and for the system that we are set to defend? what needs to be done? And we find Egan Jones literally under the gun.
Well, David, if we had a return back to the rules, okay, rules are when everyone's playing by the same rules, okay, that doesn't mean one team has one set of rules and another team has another set of rules, then what you have is you have a diminishment of the uncertainty in the markets. Right now, there is so much uncertainty that nobody's really willing to move. They don't know who's going to win the election. They don't even know if that makes a difference in the end, okay? From the long-term catastrophic point of view, who's got the solution? So it brings me back, David, to a book that you've recommended a number of times to our clients, to the guys here we've all read, Frederick Bastiat's The Law. And what he's talking about simply is, what is the rule of law and what is it there for?
And this is probably one of the most important questions that we can be asking in our generation. It'll be the braver souls of this generation that ask it. But what does the law, who does the law protect?
Right.
Any and every brave soul, I think, should read Bastiat's The Law. And frankly, consider it family-required reading.
You can read it in an hour. I mean, it's not that long.
No, and it's the kind of thing that you could put as a companion gift with next year's Christmas gifts. As long as you're wrapping it up, put it in with every gift. Buy 50 copies and give them all away.
Well, if you're going to wrap it up, you may as well wrap it up in old fiat currency, Dave. You know, the stuff that no longer has value.
I have an entire bag at home of billion mark notes back at home. And I also have a bag of billion franc note. This is quite common. We do this with fiat money. We do this when we don't have a sound monetary policy. And what we find is when you get to the end of the game, when you get to the very end of the game, politicians are going to play for keeps. As we've suggested in the past, they will choose winners or losers. And guess what? Human self-interest defines them as the default winners. They will do anything and at any cost to maintain their positions of power and prominence. The fiat money system that we've known has given them an advantage, and they're not likely to give it up easily. But I think it behooves us to determine how that game is actually played and what the expectations are that we have of our quote-unquote representative government.
Well, and I think the strange irony about giving somebody the law, the book The Law, wrapped in fiat currency is there would be a strange irony, because the politicians that you're talking about are trying to tell people right now that the wrapping paper is far more valuable than what's inside.
Again, if we were to identify a problem, one that we wanted to solve, we would ask everyone who looks at this grand social experiment, not what the French put in place 200 years ago, but what our founding fathers put in place 200 years ago, and look at the Constitution. Why did they have sound money as a basis for sound government? And if sound government can be supported by sound money, then so can sound economics. Let's begin with the basics. Let's insist that we go back to something that is beyond the PhD standard. Let's go back to the gold standard.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.